Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out this evening on a rainy night. Another rainy night in Phoenix. It's hard to believe we've had so many. And thank you to our virtual audience for joining us this evening. It was really nifty. I don't think we've ever had a father and son duo here before. But we have Mark Sullivan over there on the far right, author of Beneath the Scarlet Sky and, was it The Last Green Bell? Right. And we'll be talking to him about the fact that he has completed a new book, which he says is an even more amazing story. All roads leading back to Montana, wherever in the world they start. And to my immediate right is Connor Sullivan, Mark's son, who I saw today. We were just having a little drink and a little whatever, and I watched a video of him skiing. So I'm not sure if that works his way terribly into your book. But anyway, Connor has progressed from, what, ski bum to published author, so.
Correct, yeah.
Which is an interesting career trajectory all over the area. And I've discovered that he used to train in New Zealand. So we have that in common, too, because New Zealand's one of our very favorite places. Anyway, Connor's first book was a first mystery club pick last year. And now Wolf Trap. Why don't we have a copy up here? Patrick, why don't we have a copy on the table, Patrick? Hello? Anyway, we'll get a copy on the table. Oh, we could have your copy on the table. Great. Which I think has a wonderful cover. And with any luck, Connor will share with you the video of him doing downhill skiing, carrying a copy of Wolf Trap, which makes it look really authentic. And it's starting a series. It is not a sequel to your last book, is that right?
Correct.
Right. So fascinating future here for this author. So, Mark, I'm assuming that you are prepared to grill your son.
Grill him. Yeah. Connor, one of the things I've always been impressed about you is you're not afraid to research things, and you always manage to simplify them. So one of the things that impressed me about the book right away was that you take us into a world that we've never seen before, this world of Ground Branch, which has never been written about in any kind of depth. Can you tell me a little bit about that, what Ground Branch is, and the reality versus what's acknowledged?
Yeah, for sure. So Ground Branch was probably introduced to us, how many years ago? Three or four?
Four,
five.
Yeah.
We have a family friend who was a Navy SEAL commander of SEAL Team 6. And through him, we met this individual who ran the CIA's version of kind of SEAL Team 6. Technically, there's around 300 of these guys. They don't really exist. They work in the shadow world of covert operations, I would say. And, you know, I always wanted to write a book like Wolf Trap, but I didn't want to have a protagonist be a Navy SEAL or, you know, a Delta Force operator, because we see that a lot in fiction. And one of our friends who was very high up in Ground Branch said, why don't you write about me and us, what we did? I said, what do you do? And he started telling me this long tale over breakfast one morning about Ground Branch. And it was fascinating. And as the years went by and I started researching the book, I started to meet other people in Ground Branch. I even got into a
room. Hang out in Montana?
Yeah, well, that's the thing is a lot of them retire in Montana. A lot of them retire where we live. And I actually got in a room with the two people who run Ground Branch and asked permission to write the book, and they said, go ahead. It's a work of fiction. Go ahead.
I thought it was a joke that all roads lead to Montana, but I can see Mark, I mean, your amazing stories.
Right. And, you know, you could have knocked me over when we found out who these guys really were and what they were doing and how important they'd been to the United States. I mean, there was a movie called 12 Strong made about the first Americans into Afghanistan, and these guys were on the horses among the first 12. So that was pretty remarkable and pretty humbling, I think, to both of us, that first of all that we even knew them, but second of all that they began to trust us, and that all began with Connor, because he was the one who originally befriended them and introduced me to them. But, you know, Connor was able to use them to make a lot of contacts. And another thing that I was impressed with is that he manages to get to people that he shouldn't be able to get to, you know. And I know, because I would not have been able to get to the people that Connor gets to, and he gets to talk to them, like, you know, people very high up in the Secret Service who spent a lot of time talking to you. Tell me about that. You had to learn about the actual details of a presidential, you know, detail and how they function and where they would go and react.
Yeah, that was funny. So in Wolf Trap, it's basically about a conspiracy to kill the president of the United States. And I found these Secret Service agents, former Secret Service agents, and I kind of laid out the scenario of, like, you know, could, like, how would it happen if it happened, right? And I had a lot of the Ground Branch guys and the SEAL Team 6 guys. They call it, I think it's called red selling. Is that the right thing?
Yeah,
where they do like a mock scenario, and then they try to make sure that scenario can never happen.
Right.
So I gave the scenario that my friends, you know, took a month or so to draw up for me, that's kind of in the book, and I gave it to the Secret Service guys. And they looked at it and they said, "Who the F do you know?
How did you know that?
How did you know
function
that?"
Like this?
And they said, "That is our biggest fear, is, you know, the way it's orchestrated in the book is literally our biggest fear."
Right. The scenario that came to be the basis of it, the guy was shocked. Because it was a scenario that they had obviously considered, but not in that manner, slightly twisted, but the basis of it was there. And that's when you started to get excited. You said, okay, you know, if we got the Secret Service nervous, you know, you're on the right track for sure. Right?
Yeah. That was a fun kind of thing to lay out.
How did you get these people to talk to you when the charm and good looks of your father didn't prevail?
Beer.
But that's not indigenous to Montana. There's beer all over.
No, it starts, you know, at hunting camp around the campfire, and then you meet someone, and then it kind of, you know, they kind of vouch for you. And, you know, they told me right away, they said, "We would never talk to you if you were a journalist or if you were writing nonfiction." There've been a couple books written about them, nonfiction. I've been in the room with them and they kind of just laugh and said, "Yeah, we just lied that whole thing."
Do you suppose there was a certain amount of envy given the fact that the SEALs have had quite a lot of blockbuster fiction written about them, and all did, you know, maybe they felt somewhat overshadowed?
No, they don't want to ever.
They really didn't want to have a spotlight on
they
them.
They would never, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I was very respectful. I said, "I don't want to know about your day-to-day. I want to know about, here's the situation. What would you do in this situation?" And once you give them that, and they start to have fun with it, and they start to, you know, throw things around, and I think that's how they ended up trusting me over the last couple of years.
Right.
Because I don't ask any intrusive questions. I never ask specifics on things. They'll tell me some little thing, bits and pieces, and they'll say, "Oh, you can use that," or "Don't use that." So I try to be very respectful of that in my research.
Because they have made, you know, validated his premises, you know, in ways that I never got as a, you know, younger man as a thriller writer. Because he has people whose job, in part, is to create scenarios for national security crisis, you know, and how do they face it and how they solve it. So, you know, you were right in there with people who do that kind of thing for a living and continue to do it for countries all around the world. You know, these guys get hired to train other countries in thinking like this. How do you prevent a terrorist attack, or how do you prevent an assassination attempt? So, you know, I think it was a big learning curve for you to learn it. But the thing I like about the book also is the fact that you don't stop at the bang, bang, shoot 'em up geopolitical stuff. He actually begins, and I think this is one of the strengths of the series, is that, again, the U.S. government doesn't acknowledge these people. So when they die, nothing. The families get nothing. The kids get nothing. It's not like the SEALs. If a SEAL dies in combat, the family's taken care of. The kids go to college. You know, their SEAL Foundation. But there was nothing like that for Ground Branch. And so Connor and I O'Connor first and then invited me, and we were allowed to meet these people who were involved in something called the Third Option Foundation. And they raise money basically for the wives and children of our assassins.
Yeah, and it, that was a kind of a shocking thing, is you meet these people and they dedicate their whole lives to this. You know, they're like intellectuals. I kind of call them like the Buddhist warriors. That's how I would describe a lot of them. They're not, you know, the big guy.
They look like soccer dads. When you first meet them, you're like, there's no way this is who they are, but it is who they are.
And it's pretty incredible. Since the government doesn't acknowledge their existence, there's no government assistance if they die. The families get nothing. So they created the Third Option Foundation in, I think, 2013.
Yeah.
And what they do is, you know, if one of these guys gets hurt, they're able to get them the best medical care.
Yeah.
A lot of them suffer from debilitating PTSD. So they get them the best therapists and psychologists in the world. Make sure they're...
How are they paid? I mean, they're not obviously...
Very wealthy people spend...
So, the Third Option Foundation goes to wealthy donors and gives them this closed-door pitch in a very small room, kind of like this. We've been in the room before. And in the room,
they'll be... You mean for regular salary as well as death benefits?
Well, this is just for Third Option Foundation.
Okay, but in the course of their normal pursuits...
You know, they don't make much money. No.
They don't.
No.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. How are they recruited?
They recruit through Tier 1 units. So they'll take guys in SEAL Team 6 who are kind of at the end of their career, and they'll come through and they'll say, do you want to come work for the agent? And what they do is they'll put them through operations officer training. So they'll train them how to be a spy. So you got this guy who, 15, 20 years in the SEAL teams, Delta Force, MARSOC, will train them to be a spy for about 2 years and all sorts of other trainings, about 2 years, and then they put them in.
So is it hard for guys like that to leave the life, you know, where they've had
missions
and adrenaline and so forth?
Lot of the guys are in their 60s.
Wow.
True.
And they're operating right now.
On any given night in the world, there is a ground branch operation. Almost 365 nights a year, which was shocking when we heard that.
And it's kind of like once you're in, you're in. A lot of the times, like, the people who back out are, they want people for life. And, in my book, my main character is a legacy. So their grandfather then. So the grandfather, the father, the son.
Which is common. We know people who came out of Marines and MARSOC and these Tier 1s, and then their kids are coming behind them, and now they're being considered to be, it's an elite force that we don't acknowledge and we don't praise. It's just, it doesn't exist. It has to happen. I mean, when you meet these guys and you talk with them, you thank God that there are people like this operating for us in the world, because they are, as Connor said, they're like warrior monks when you meet them, in the sense that they're very intellectual. I mean, one of Connor's main sources and this friend of ours, he's a Stoic philosopher. That's what he does in his spare time. And yet he knows more about national security than we've ever known. And yet he was a field fighter for a long time. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
So, what happens in Wolf Trap?
So,
as far as you want to go, don't take it too far.
So, Wolf Trap is about a conspiracy at the highest levels of the government. It centers around a president, Angela Buchanan, who is trying to pass a green initiative, which is basically becoming carbon neutral. And she kind of is like a bull in the china shop. She goes in, she has a grassroots campaign, she wins, she becomes president. And when that happens, she then says, the United States, with this new Green Deal, a green initiative in my book, I want to push the global green accord. So I want the whole world to become green, essentially. Cut out the fossil fuel industry, the petrochemical industry. And obviously when that happens, the whole world kind of goes crazy. And the book is about people high up in the American government who are trying to make sure that does not happen. Yeah, by conspiring to kill her. And my main character, Brian Rome, kind of gets taken in, and he kind of front and center in the conspiracy to stop it.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much everything in the book is either based on an event that has happened in real life, and I just twist it a little bit. There's a Jamal Khashoggi character in it. Literally every single thing that happens in the book is something that's happened in real life that I just slightly tweak.
Things that are known and unknown.
Yes, things that are unknown.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff that
doesn't seem...
It might seem not reality,
That was the most fun part about writing the book, is that I had to come to some of my network of friends and say, how would we do this? And they would give me this outlandish, thing to do.
At first glance. Yeah.
And I was like, no, we need to make this look real. It seems to be real. I'm like, oh, I did that. That's real. So I put that in. It was very fun to write.
Yeah.
How did you move over to that from writing your first book, which was this is the start of a series, but your first book was not.
Yeah, well, the first book, I always wanted to write kind of as a standalone. But I think deep down, I grew up reading Vince Flynn, grew up reading Brad Thor. I always kind of wanted to write a book, in that vein, just to see if I could do it and write a series. And I've always been very interested in that. So when these people started coming into our lives, it was just kind of like a no-brainer. I'm like, I have the access to this that no other, fiction writer really has right now. So I just
that we know of anyway.
Yeah, but I wanted to get a shot at it. Yeah. So.
You're talking about the rim, but yeah. I thought your first book, I love the Arctic setting. I like the driving, because I joined with driving to Alaska with the dogs.
Yeah.
To visit our friend in Homer. And, I've always sort of wanted to drive the Alaskan Highway through Canada. So I was fascinated with, because that's where I'm going blank on the, what's the title?
Sleeping Bear.
Thank you. There were some opening scenes in Sleeping Bear that had a lot to do with, that kind of a trip, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because they're on their way there and then stuff happens. But I wasn't sure that you could really write a sequel to Sleeping Bear.
I never planned on it. I get asked like twice a week if I'm writing a sequel to it. I think I probably will eventually. I'm going to do at least two more books of this series, and then I'll probably dip my toe in writing a sequel to Sleeping Bear or just doing something else.
Well, you like, obviously, like high adventure and high action.
Yeah.
I wonder where you learned that.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, I swear, Mark, one day I'm really going to go back to St. Moritz and stay in the hotel. Mark wrote this amazing story, which I cannot remember, but it had this astonishing scene where a guy has to, scale the outside of this upscale hotel in St. Moritz. Right. So I carefully arranged a trip so that I could go and stay in this hotel and kind of reimagine the whole scene.
Yeah.
I love Mark's books, the ones he wrote before Beneath the Scarlet Sky. And when we got there, it turned out that October, the hotel closes for a whole month every year. I was so pissed. I know. I mean, there I was. So I stood outside it and tried to imagine, because you have a really great break-in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Because the object is people breaking into the hotel, not breaking out of the hotel. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually stayed in that hotel when I was an investigative reporter, and it was right when the season opened back up.
November.
Late November, early December, and there were these dowager princesses and weird violin guys, and I was like, oh, I'm taking notes on this place. This is 35 years ago, but I've never forgotten it. So.
Yeah, well, you failed to mention in the book that they're closed in October.
sorry.
Right. I was there in conjunction with the Frankfurt Book Fair, which takes place in October, so I didn't have any other particular reason to be in that part. There's a gorgeous, you can take all kinds of trains through Switzerland in the, what's it called? The Bernini Express goes from St. Moritz down into Italy, but the Ice Something Hotel goes from wherever the Matterhorn is to
Zermatt
to St. Moritz.
Yeah.
So you can do this kind of whole circle train trip through Switzerland, which is Gorgeous.
Cool.
Yeah. And then you take the William Tell Express from Lake Como to Lucerne, and you float across the lake. And then you can take another train from Lucerne back to Montrose. So it's a whole circle from Montrose if you do that.
Beautiful. Connor, one of the things that really interested me in the book was the setting that and your exploration of the Saudi kingdom. That seems to me, you know, as a fellow researcher writer, the biggest black hole you could ever go down into, because, you know, there's so much intrigue in ways that we don't imagine in any other country right now, because courtiers and all this palace intrigue still goes on there in ways that, you know, went on across Europe forever. So what attracted you to that?
I don't remember where the idea came from to focus on Saudi Arabia as kind of, you know, my bad guys. It must have been an article or something, but I do this thing when I'm writing a book that I research so much that it becomes my procrastination to not write. So I just went down the rabbit hole into the Saudi royal family and, you know, what, you know, how does that country, that kingdom work right now? So I just started reading everything on Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, the history of Saudi Arabia, just everything going on today. And man, that was like a 6-month rabbit hole I went down.
You did.
And it's fascinating. It's, you know, here's a country with basically unlimited money. You know, Saudi Aramco, their oil company, is the most wealthy company in the world. We don't even know how much money is even in there, because mm-hmm. they hide everything. And that money that they have, the trillions and trillions of dollars, it sits in a public investment fund that is controlled by the Saudi crown prince. So he has more money pretty much than anyone in the world. And what does he do with that money? Whatever he wants to get up on other nations, to get up on other states. And it's,
in this case, he's trying to flip the balance of power in the world, right? Because if the balance of power goes against him with a green accord, he's in big trouble, right?
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is that when I got the idea for the book, I started my research, and about 3 months into the research, Mohammed bin Salman killed Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the floodgates kind of opened. And we had, you know, some of our friends knew like the insider account of what happened.
So yeah.
He was murdered.
We knew before
it got out. Yep. Mm-hmm. And we knew the storm that was coming.
Yeah.
So I immediately started to do, you know, my research on that, talking to people in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I don't get in trouble writing about this.
Just don't go to Saudi Arabia for the next 10 years, you'd be fine.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking down that rabbit hole for 6 months, like, they all know you're on the computer doing that.
Yeah, well, that's what the book is about that. So the book is about them buying a Pegasus system. And if you don't know what the Pegasus system is.
Good thing you have friends in high places that can.
Yeah. We always joke about that.
So what is the Pegasus system? Yeah.
So the Pegasus system, it was developed by I'm pretty sure it's a public company out of Israel called NSO Group.
Yep.
Right.
And Pegasus system is like a cloak and dagger type system that anyone can buy if you have the money. That's like the Saudis bought it from Israeli company. And it can basically say, you know, I wanna infiltrate that guy's phone. To do is click a button, send him some sort of email or text. If he opens that email or text, they're in. Now, that was Pegasus 2. Pegasus 3 doesn't need an email or text. You can just go, I want to get into Jack Stewart's phone. And they know everything. And they can do it to anyone.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what the book is about. And that's how they did that to Jamal Khashoggi. Jamal Khashoggi was complaining about his iPhone being hot to the touch and the battery draining.
Yeah.
It's because the crown prince's guys, the Pegasus system. They knew where he was going to be, and they murdered him.
Wow.
Which is why Spycraft is actually going back to old school.
It is.
We've had a lot of conversations about that with writers of spy fiction, and they're going back to like letter drops. And you can't hack a letter. You know, yeah, you can leave a folded newspaper or, you know, a note in a tree or something, and the Pegasus system, they can't help you with that. So I think it's intriguing that the world got so technical and so vulnerable as a consequence that it's going to go back to, you know, lemon juice ink or urine or, you know, whatever it is. And I mean, it's really an interesting reversal.
It is. Yeah, it's fascinating.
So you're lucky the Iran thing didn't come up until last year book was out.
Yeah.
A sort of realignment there with the Saudis. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how that, you know, how that goes on.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go well. Because it's Sunni and Shia. Mm-hmm. There's still that division. I don't think it's going to go anymore.
China's sort of flexing its muscle briefly.
Yeah, but I mean, the ultimate is that, you know, the Ayatollahs don't believe that the Saudis should, you know, run that part of the religion. So this has been going on for like 900 years, that sort of stuff.
I've been studying the Saudis for the Gaul. I'm not fond of the LIB, right? I know. So, yeah. But that's just another way that they're trying to tunnel into the West is to tunnel into sports.
Yeah.
Right. So, assuming that you're going to continue this, what's your next target?
Well, I guess I could say it. I'm going to definitely work on China, the South China Sea. So that's where I asked my friends. I said, "So, what keeps you up at night?" Go, China keeps me up at night. So what about China keeps you up at night? And it's their infiltration of every facet of our government, our corporations, their
TikTok.
The apps that kids are using, the IC, the intelligence community, is having a lot of problems with, you know, they're stationed in somewhere in the world and their kids are on TikTok in their house all day, recording their house. So Chinese spy agencies can know exactly what the house is like, how the parents act around the kids with the phones on all the time. So my book is going to, my next one in the series is going to take place around the theme of Havana Syndrome, which has been going on now since 2016. Does anyone know what Havana Syndrome is? So in my book, I'm going to be tying in Havana Syndrome and what the weapon actually is and who's using it and why. And then I'm gonna tie that into the Chinese and what's going on right now in the South China Sea, where they're trying to expand
their control empire of all these deserted islands and now it makes a big build, yeah, in the middle of nowhere.
So we'll see how that goes.
Right. So, Mark, how does it feel to have a kid writing? He's not muscling into your territory exactly, but...
I think it's great. I didn't expect he would end up being a writer, except for one fact, is he was a voracious reader. You know, and the thing is, if you're not a voracious reader, you're unlikely to become a good writer. It's just not going to happen. So he was already ticking that box right away, that he read a lot. And after the whole ski racing career ended with the crashes and stuff, he said that's what he wanted to do. And he's definitely afraid to tell me. And I was like, well, I'm not telling you not to be a writer. You just got to know what the pitfalls are and the reality of what a life of a writer and, you know, these days is. And luckily, you know, through osmosis, growing up in a house where his dad wrote every day, he knew what it took. And the really cool thing is that he did it on his own. Yeah. He took the time. He was working for me and for Greg Hurwitz as a researcher. And that, you know, that helped. He was able to keep it going. But he did something very smart. And he stopped showing me stuff for almost 2 years. And when he came back after 2 years, he had it. I knew it. I read, you know, his draft of Sleeping Bear, and what's the first thing I said to you? You're going to publish this. I knew it. I mean, I could just tell it was of that quality right away. But it wasn't of the quality when he went into that two-year woodshedding, you know. But really, he did the right thing. he stopped showing it to people. He stopped talking about it. He worked on it till it was good enough that it, you know, it did what it did and got all this amazing recognition right off the bat. Yeah. And he also, he studied the craft. He was, Greg will tell you, Greg Hurwitz will tell you also that we both told him the same thing. And we both tell the same thing to everybody is find what you want to write, the area you want to write, genre, however you want to refer to it, and read everything. Read the good stuff so that you're super familiar with it and you understand how it's done. And I got to say that of all the people I've ever told, and evidently Greg says the same thing, the only person who ever did what we told him to do was him.
That's really fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I've been with Greg his entire career, except for his first book.
Yeah.
Every book.
Yeah.
Here and all. And I have watched Greg grow and change.
Exponentially. You know, in every direction.
Absolutely. And then, you know, he hit on a great idea. He was just here in February for Orphanix.
Yep.
But it took him years to prepare to be able to write Orphanix.
Yeah.
But I would think that he would be a terrific example for you.
Yeah, I mean, I saw what it took to be a novelist, to be a working writer. It requires an incredible amount of discipline and, you know, being able to kind of be alone a lot and work on your craft by yourself. And, you know, in a world where this thing is everything, it's like I had to really kind of shift my kind of my whole life of how I'm, you know, what I really want to do. Do I want to be a writer? Do I want to be looking at my phone all the time? And it was, you know, I just
kind of... have to have a terrifically supportive wife.
Yes. Yeah.
Too bad. I'm going to give her a week over there. No, but it does, because being a writer, you're always accompanied by imaginary friends.
Yeah.
And sometimes they get in the way of, you know, actual people because you're deeply in, you know, embedded with them.
Yeah. My wife deserves a lot of credit for putting up with me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it is a very solitary existence, and you, when something's going wrong in your writing, it's your whole world, and it just feels like it's collapsing, and, you know, so you got to have a good, you know, support system.
Yeah, I've always thought it wasn't so much the solitary time as the fact that when you emerge, you still have all those people in your head with you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so getting your undivided attention is difficult.
Yeah, and I really struggled with that. I think when I was in college, I really started to take writing seriously, but I couldn't just leave my writing in, you know, my room, my office. It would always come, you know, home with me, and I'd just be stressed out and, you know, living in these fantasy worlds. But now I think I'm pretty good at like compartmentalizing the writing part of my day and then my real life, I think. You can ask her if she gets back with
it. So, Mark, how's it been for you? Because, you know, you and I have known each other forever. Before, back when you were authoring by yourself, before you started writing with Patterson, and certainly before you wrote Beneath the Scarlet Sky, and I call it the Green Book.
The Last Green Ballot.
Right. Yeah. Which is certainly a topical book since it starts in the Ukraine and spends so much of its time in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
But, and I'm not... Do you feel like you could not have written those two bestsellers if you hadn't spent time working with Patterson?
I couldn't have. You know, when I went to work with him, I thought I knew a lot about commercial fiction writing, but I really didn't. And it was like the first year of working with him was every time I talked to him, which at that point was every 1 to 2 weeks, it was like taking a master class. You know, I used to joke when I would go into, I have a separate building on our property where I write. And we're calling rents now because I live up with Big Sky during the winter. One of the things that I always say was it was like I was talking to Yoda. You know, once a week, I got to talk to Yoda and get these pearls of wisdom. And I always tell people he's the smartest story guy I ever met. And he taught me more about story than anything. So there's a strong plot to each of these books. The great thing is that the plots were basically handed to me because they're based on true stories. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to go crazy in a field and make up a lot of stuff because it was there for me. But then using a lot of, you know, Patterson's approach to storytelling, it creates a lot of momentum. That's what it does in the writing. What I like to do is imagine that every single letter and every single word and every single sentence and every single paragraph and every single chapter is all linked by a line that goes all the way through these things to the end of the book. And my thought process is always that the weight of the book has to be at the end, so that when I'm writing, I'm constantly asking myself, is the weight of that ending out there? And if it is, I'm fine. I just keep going. But that's how I do it. And I learned a lot of that.
It's certainly true that if you want to have a successful book, the end has to be as good or better than the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many books that start out with some, you know, fabulous opener, and then they just don't deliver on it.
Right.
And so the best books are the ones where you do as you say, where you're able to put weight on the end and make the journey that the reader took with you worth doing.
Sure.
All right, so why don't you talk a moment about your two books for people who don't know them? I think Beneath the Scarlet Sky was one that we did an event here together with, and it's an amazing story. I still don't understand how they all end up in Montana. How does that work?
Well, you know, with Beneath, it was this, you know, one person told the story to another person, told the story to another person, and I met the third person. Yeah. And then that book, consumed my life. It was my passion project for like a decade. I kept going back to Italy, kept going back to Germany, talking to everybody and trying to get
the main character lived to be.
Yeah, he's still alive. Yeah,
like 100 now.
He's 94. Okay. I'm gonna go see him next month, which is wonderful. My wife and I are gonna get to go to Milan again and see him. We're looking forward to it. But yeah, he's still alive. He still doesn't think he's a hero. You know, he says anybody would have done what I did, and that's his attitude. But that book brought me, after I wrote this book, people kept telling me, I'll never find another book like that one again. And I said, no, I don't think I went through what I did to write that one and learn how to write historical fiction if I wasn't supposed to do it twice. And then I was giving a talk about Beneath the Scarlet Sky in Bozeman at a noontime rotary, and this guy comes up and says, do you know these people in town, the Martells? And I said, well, like the construction company. He said, yeah. He said, the entire time I was reading Beneath, all I could think of was the Martells and how they came to America. You need to hear the story. And the crazy thing is I said, okay, I'll go. And Bill Martell is like a town father kind of guy. He helps build football stadiums and things like that. I drive to his house, it's like 2 minutes from where we live, and I turn on the road and I get this weird feeling. And it was because when I got to Bill's house, I realized that I was less than 250 meters or yards from where I heard this book, in the same little neighborhood in our town. So it's not just that all roads lead to Montana, all roads lead to Bozeman.
All right. Well, talk to us a little bit about the second book, because with the war in the Ukraine, it becomes even more relevant and exciting than when you wrote it.
Yeah. The Last Green Valley is about an exodus that most people don't understand or didn't know about, of ethnic Germans who were offered to run with the Nazis as they're escaping and retreating out of Russia, including what we now call Ukraine. And they're faced with an impossible decision right at the beginning of the book. Do they stay and wait for the Soviet bear to return, or do they run with the Nazi wolves that they've come to despise during the occupation? And they run with the wolves because they've sworn to protect them. They don't know why. And what happens is this incredible 1,600-mile journey in the equivalent of a Conestoga wagon caught between two armies as they're going across Europe in the last years of the war. And researching it, I became very aware very early on that, the Russians invading Ukraine has happened like 8 times that I know, going back to Peter the Great. It's like everybody knew that it was the breadbasket of the world, and everybody wanted control of it from Catherine the Great on. And she was the reason that the Martells were there. And that story just gave me a deep appreciation for what the Ukrainian people are going through. And it really makes me understand how hard they're fighting, because they know what happens if Russia wins. They know. And if they don't know personally, their dad knows or their grandparent knows. They know what's coming and it's not good. And so they're fighting tooth and nail. And I think just understanding that aspect of it, if you read the book, you get a true appreciation for what's going on.
Right. I'm not sure people understand how many ethnic Germans were actually, they were there for farming primarily.
That's right.
You know, it reminds me of Egypt in its day in the Roman Empire. Egypt was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire back when it was far more fertile. And that's why there was so much fighting over Egypt. That's why, you know, Actium and all the rest of it. And so, as you say, the Ukraine. And that, you know, Russia, until recently, had no warm water port.
Right.
Except going down through the Black Sea and out through the, you know, the Turkish Straits.
Yeah.
I did a master's thesis on that when I was an undergraduate about how hard Russia tried to take control of that area. And that's why Peter the Great actually went and built St. Petersburg in part, so he could have a warm water port. Now you can go to Murmansk. I've actually been to Murmansk. Never going again. But Murmansk, which was a big port during World War II, but it was an Arctic port, but... You know, with the way climate change is, Russia now actually can go out of Murmansk. And, it's the Black Sea port is not as important to them, but the Ukrainian grain.
Yeah.
And also, they just wanted as a buffer, according to Putin, you know, the West, the evil West, was going to gobble up the Ukraine and threaten Russia on its vulnerable southern flank.
Which is exactly right.
A truly terrible excuse for what he's done.
Yeah.
Right. So what are you working on now?
I've written another historical fiction. It's more modern historical fiction, I guess you'd call it. It's based on a true untold story that Connor actually brought to me. He heard it first, and the generous son that he is, he said, "Dad, this isn't my book, it's yours," and called me up and told me. And it's about... two children, boy and a girl, both 14, who get kidnapped in northern Uganda in 1994 by this messianic warlord named Joseph Kony. And Kony ends up kidnapping 37,000 children. But none of those children gets closer to Kony than this guy, Anthony. He's 14 when he's taken. And he becomes Kony's radio man. He sees everything. He hears everything. And then this girl, Florence, gets kidnapped. And she gets taken into the madness of Kony's world. And the interesting thing about him is that both boy and girl were raised in, you know, small villages in Uganda. And yet their parents instilled in them at a very young age a sense of values, principles, and it was all based on what it means to be a good human. Not a good man, not a good woman, a human. And these lessons stick with them, even though they're in this situation that's trying to brainwash them and to make them into, you know, automatons and human soldiers. And they managed to hold on to it, and right around the fifth year of what's a 10-year ordeal, they meet each other. And they legitimately fall in love. And the power of love saves, allows them to unearth these values and principles that allows them to survive, which is a situation that is largely unsurvivable. And not only that, they escape. And when they get out, they turn the tables on Kony. And they become part of the forces hunting Kony to try to bring him to justice. And Anthony ends up being the prime witness at a trial in The Hague to put the top guys of Kony's organization in prison. And he and his wife get on the radio and call the other children out of the bush. It's the most remarkable story I've ever heard. Because when you meet, when you actually meet these people, you know, just think of what they did. They got 10 years of their life stolen by a lunatic. And yet, you know, in this day and age, everybody'd be screaming, "I'm a victim, I'm a victim." There's none of that. They're like transcendent people. They glow because they understand that the only reason they survived was because they held on to their common humanity. And that's what they talk about all the time. And it's just a remarkable experience to first of all know them and now to tell their story.
And when do we get to read this?
May of 24.
Sounds amazing. Yeah. Although I have some trouble believing it could be even more astonishing than the two books that you are on the table there.
I don't know, Connor's right. Is it more astonishing?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably my favorite one.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I think the guy in Beneath the Scarlet Sky is just so unbelievable.
Yeah,
and,
he is.
You know, it's hard to even imagine that it's not just fiction.
I think it's, you know, with Anthony and Florence, is their circumstances and, you know, that they're real people, and I got them to open up to me because it was not easy what they went through. It was brutal in situations. And again, they somehow managed to hold on to their basic humanity. And that's the real amazing thing about the story, is that that's what shines through. You know, the things your parents teach you can have profound effects on you the rest of your life. They really can. And when you meet people like them and you see it in action, in a sense, it really changes you, moves you. Makes you realize how you want to conduct yourself and how you want to treat other people.
How did this story come to your notice?
To me?
Mm-hmm. Well, you passed it on to him. So
yeah, it came through my friends who helped me write my book.
Yeah.
They were the ones sent by the Obama administration to kill Connie in 2013 or 14?
12, 13, yeah.
And when they were hunting Connie, they met this guy who was, I think he was their interpreter at one point.
No, he was he was an advisor to the Americans because he spoke pretty good English and he understood how the LRA worked. They didn't know who he was at that point.
Yeah, they were hunting Connie. They're trying to find him when he was
in Congo.
In the Congo. He's participating in the illegal ivory trade.
Okay.
And they knew that he showed up to this ivory trade every June or July, and they were just waiting. And when they were waiting, this guy Anthony was, you know, very quiet, and then he eventually kind of said, like, "Oh, I know Connie." He said, "What do you mean you know Connie?" Because he kidnapped me when I was, you know, 13 or 14. I was his radio man. I was the voice on the radio for him. I was his voice.
I was 9 weeks
before I escaped. And they went, "What?" And then, you know, they became very close friends with the family. I mean, our friends with the godfather, with all the kids.
Yeah.
They're very, you know.
But what was great is that here are these, you know, a guy who's CEO, another guy who's like this big CIA guy. And what they're most impressed with right away when they hear the story is the depth of the humanity. That this is a universal story. You know, and they knew it, they could feel it, and they tried to make a documentary about it. They did a, you know, pretty decent job given what they could do, but they realized that the only way that we were going to, because they became convinced after hearing the story that child soldiering had to end. And this is coming from two top military warriors, and they said, this can't go on anymore. After you hear the story, you realize that it just can't go on anymore. So the idea was that the story would help end child soldiering. And to that, it's going to, because we formed a nonprofit, End Child Soldiering, with these guys. And we have people from UNICEF and the UN coming in on our board. And a significant portion of the proceeds from this book are going to End Child Soldiering, as well as we're going to use it to raise funds all over the world to end it.
Wow, what a wonderful thing for you to be able to do that sort of thing through the power of your fiction, Mark.
Yeah, it is. It's an amazingly fulfilling thing. And again, I felt like I was honored to be asked to do it. And, you know, I got to go to Uganda and spend all sorts of time with Anthony and Florence, and got to go see where a lot of these things happened, and begin to understand the geography of it. And, you know, it became very real as to what these, because it wasn't just them. I interviewed, I don't know, over 50 child soldiers.
So your background as a journalist really helps you with all this, doesn't it?
It does a lot.
Yeah. Right. Oh, how wonderful. You guys have got a very wonderful thing going on, don't you?
Yeah.
And you're in a kind of living laboratory of them, how to be a writer, right?
Correct.
From ski bum to writer. Well, actually, you're a ski bum. You're
ski racer.
Sorry, ski racer. That was unfortunate. I'm sorry. I chose a bad word there.
That's true.
So, you have questions from the audience? Any of you would like to ask questions?
Do you have a title for your upcoming book?
Yes, it's called All the Glimmering Stars.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a wonderful title.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Glad I can help you out.
Thank you. No, it's because the title was bouncing around. But
right. Same publisher?
Same publisher.
Like, right.
Yeah, they're very excited about it.
I think I sometimes take a little heat from this from independent bookstores, but I think Amazon Publishing does one. You have to separate it from Amazon otherwise.
Right.
But they really have done, I think, some wonderful things. And certainly, I don't think that Beneath the Scarlet Sky would have become the giant bestseller that it did without their support.
I think that's exactly true. Yeah, absolutely true.
I really enjoy working with them.
Me too.
Well, yeah, obviously you do. Okay, take a little heat there. Right. Anybody else have a question? Yes, sir?
Connor, in your research for the Ground Branch, have you come across Maritime Branch and Air Branch, and will those factor into future books?
A little bit. I mentioned them in my book, but I didn't want to confuse my audience too much. But yeah, I will do some stuff into that. I have a friend of a friend who is Maritime Branch. Well, I'll be kind of talking
to you. Do you want to elaborate on the difference between ground, maritime, and air? I mean, it sounds simple, but it's probably
not. Sure, yeah. I mean, if you just think of, you know, Navy, Air Force, Army. Ocean, water, air, ground. The CIA has their own version of that, just very small compared to Navy or Army and stuff. So they're doing, like, Maritime does a lot of, like, you know, pirate stuff, like ship stuff, things that you'll never hear about on the news. Air is pretty secretive.
Yeah. And
you probably know more about
that. It's interesting that the piracy thing, which was so big in the Indian Ocean for a while, seems to have died away. But I mean, for a while there, it was like there was hardly a ship that was safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still going on. We just don't see it that much in the media.
Or maybe it's on a smaller scale.
I don't know. Do you know?
I think it's still going on because I just spoke to this woman who's, she works on and off with the UN envoy for children in military situations. And that's the whole point. It's like, okay, so Joseph Kony was 37,000 children. He trained them. He did all these things. But there's all sorts of other ways that kids become child combatants. And that's what we've been learning just talking to these people, is that, like with the pirates, right, a lot of the pirates were kids. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very young, you know, teenagers when they would go out on these boats. And so that there's how do kids, you know, you have a situation where Joseph Kony kidnapped him, put him through actual military training. Well, there's also kids who become combatants just because they don't get to go to school. They live in northern Syria during the civil war. Someone, you know, moves in next door. Hi, I'm with ISIS. Want a gun? They're off and going. So we're learning that there are all sorts of different ways that children get sucked into this world. And we're going to work with the right NGOs, nonprofits, et cetera, to begin to every year identify where the need is greatest. So if it's in the Philippines that this is going on, then we go to the Philippines. If it's Indonesia, it doesn't matter where it is. It has to do with children being asked to carry arms. And we disagree with it.
Anyone else?
Oh, I have a question.
Sure.
Relative to Sleeping Bear and the drones, Russian drones and American drones, and in the Post the other day, I guess, you know, we shot down a drone over Canada, and now Russia shot down one of our drones up there in Alaska, where the story kind of takes place. And I was just curious about how your research might have touched on some of the drone action up there.
I don't think I really did too much on drones and Sleeping Bear that I can't remember. I'm more did UAV stuff in Wolf Trap. But I mean, yeah, from my research, they're everywhere. Like, they're all over the place. The
balloons are everywhere.
But I
so
mean,
it's no news. It's no, they're just it, there absolutely. All the time.
But I mean, they're always spying on us with their satellites. A balloon going over us isn't necessarily a big deal.
It just happened to be in Montana.
Yeah.
Like over it was. It was floating over on the state. That's how it got caught.
So we have an Alaska author, Dana Stabenow, who will be here on April 11th with Jen Sanford. They're doing a double book lunch together. And her book, her whole book was inspired by her walking out into her backyard and there was a drone overhead. And the drone, yeah, it's a really cool plant.
That is really cool.
The drone plays a significant role, but not the one that you would imagine.
Yeah.
In the book. But we were chased in Stockholm. Rob and I were walking in Old Town Stockholm, and we were suddenly being chased by a drone. And it appeared that it was a recreational drone. There was some guy in some island over there, because, you know, Stockholm's all island, that was just having a good time, like flying a kite, except that he was flying a drone right over us. But it was a really creepy feeling, you know, to have that thing up there. But, you know, if you have your roof repaired, do you know that your roofer will now bring a drone and fly it over your house, which is really brilliant to look at your roof? But we've had that done once to repair it and then to check it. Now they don't climb up on ladders. They fly a drone now over your seriously, which makes a lot of sense if you think about it, you know, to pinpoint. Yeah. And then I'm pretty sure that Google Maps is using drones like crazy.
Yeah.
Chimney
they
people
have
to.
Use
them too. Chimney. They want to show the structure up around the top of the roof.
Yeah, and actually, if you watch particularly foreign crime fiction streaming on MHC, my favorite channel, because there are all these great. Anyway, they're using drones now, and the scenery is spectacular, you know, in whatever country you happen to be watching. So obviously, for cinematography, you know, drones have opened up an entire new world they could never have done before.
That's
right. So there are lots of great uses for them, but there's some sinister uses as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Love it. Anybody else? No? Oh. All right. Well, then, thank you very much for joining us, virtual audience, and thank you all for coming this evening. Mark and Connor will be happy to sign books for you, and I think we'll just leave them here in their chairs. So, oh, sorry.
I'm just ready to talk.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you had a question. But then, so, let's give our authors a round of applause. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.